State Affairs meeting to order. This is Tuesday, March 17th, 2009, and the time is 9 o'clock. I'd like to wish everybody a happy St. Patrick's Day, and at this time, if you'd please turn off any electronic devices, cell phones, appreciate that. Please let the record reflect that we have with us today Senator Kevin Myers, Senator Joe Passavant, and Senator Menard. I would like to also introduce my committee aide, Debbie Prater. On the agenda today, we will be hearing the following bills. Senate Bill 78, Legislative Audit Division Powers. Senate Bill 23, Repeal Defined Contribution Retirement Plans. House Bill 63, Council on Domestic Violence Members Staff. It is not my intent today to move out Senate Bill 23 or House Bill 63, but we will have the hearings on it. So let's begin with Senate Bill 78, Legislative Audit Division Powers, and the committee recognizes Senator Fred Dyson. Would you state your name and forward and give testimony? Thank you.
Fred Dyson, District I, Senate District I. Thanks to the committee for hearing this bill, and you, Madam Chair.
Oh, at this time, I would like to recognize Senator Hollis French for joining us. Thank you. And are we ready online and on net? Do we have anybody else? Okay. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Our auditor, Pat, who's sitting in the back, has frustrated me significantly over the years, and every case I was wrong and she was right, and I have come to the conclusion that that's a very well-run function, and they have done an excellent job for us. My frustration was that Pat reads our code to say that the limits of her authority are only to audit state organizations, and I wanted and assumed that the audit function could go and audit any organization that receives state funds. And Pat is uncertain that the code gives her that authority. The bill you have before us makes it clear that it does. And I believe she will tell you that she's in agreement with that. So we tried to run this bill before. And I got into this a few years ago when I was hearing that some of the pass-through grants that were going through state divisions were kind of insider deals where the people steering the grants, the money went to very close associations, including family members. And I'm not making any assertions here that that's true, but I was concerned about it. And I've asked PATA over the years to audit some functions where I thought things were being misused, and she graciously said, we don't believe we have the authority to do that. when Governor Murkowski assumed office, he said quite publicly that he was surprised at how little audit organization there was in the executive branch. I've seen this audit function, the legislative audit function, do some magnificent work. And so it's my desire that we make it clear that they have the authority to do audits anywhere public funds that pass through state hands, how they're used. I believe it's a part of our role as stewards of the public funds to be able to do that. And I think you'll understand as you look at the bill, that still is all at the direction of LBNA. And Pat doesn't go off arbitrarily to audit things. She is indeed subject to the legislature's direction and has done a good, if not magnificent, job of that. So also there's a drafting error on page 1, line 4, I don't believe I intended this, but the drafter changed the word may or shall to may, and on that first sentence, and I believe Pat will tell you that it probably ought to go back to shall, and I certainly am agreeing. The only changes are on page 2, and it just makes it a new paragraph there that makes it clear that we and her office has the authority to track public monies that go through the state wherever they go. Okay. I've just told you more than I know.
Okay. Are there any questions of, okay, Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Dyson. Just so I understand this correctly, this would include any federal money that's passed through the state, including the economic stimulus money that we're currently receiving or will receive?
It is clear. My intention is that we have the authority to audit any monies, public monies, that pass through state hands.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks. Is there any Senator French?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dyson, my question is about that authority and how far it would spread. Assume, say, for example, the Boy Scouts of Eagle River got $5,000 to do some work on their ball fields. Would your bill allow for a total audit of all of the Boy Scouts of Eagle River, or would it be just limited to that $5,000?
Yeah, a good question. It's my intention that it be just to track the money that went through our hands, not the other. But I'll let Pat, because there's an implication there that I'm not prepared to answer. I will tell you that I hear from the district in which, or the borough in which you and I are elected, that grants from the state for projects, that money, all the money wasn't spent and it had been siphoned off to other things. You know, and I don't know that, but I'd love for Pat to have the authority to be able to chase that down and find out and so on. But that's a question I'll defer to Pat and maybe our legal folks.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do you have anyone else on the committee have any questions? Not? Thank you very much.
Oh, and okay. Excuse me, one more thing. If you all chose to adopt this as a committee bill, I would be delighted. I think it's just good public policy, and I am eager for it to get through whoever's leading the parade. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to provide public testimony? Pat, you want to come forward, state your name, affiliation, and give your testimony, please? And there might be committee members that have questions.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, Pat Davidson, Legislative Auditor, representing the Division of Legislative Audit. With regard to the bill, I did have a concern that Senator Dyson has already voiced, and that was taking out the word shall on line 4 and making it a may. That would weaken what I believe is our current authority in an area. The other comment that I have is, in this section of law, the existing sections of law, there's two areas that make the audit division as effective and as efficient as it is. And those, one is the item number 6, which says have access at all times to books, accounts, reports, and other records, whether confidential or not, of every state agency. It also requires assistance and cooperation of all state officials and other state employees on the inspection, examination, and audit of state agency books and accounts. Those are two areas, as I said, that make the audit division as effective and efficient as possible. Because both Section 5 and 6 refer to state agencies, if in Section 11 you do want to expand the division's authority to follow state money into nonprofits or local governments, the committee may want to consider addressing those issues as well. It would be my position on the bill is we are a service agency to the legislature. If it's the legislature's policy call that you want us to be following that state money to wherever it goes, I'm fine with that. makes for some interesting audits. Actually, as Senator Dyson indicated, it's a little difficult right now once state money leaves state agencies on whether we can or cannot audit. If there is a grant agreement that allows the department to audit the money, then our ability to audit goes with that. We'll sort of stand in the shoes. However, there's a lot of money that flows out of the state without a lot of strings, revenue sharing, various things like that, where because there is no stated audit authority, that's where our ability stops. And so it's situation specific as to whether or not we can follow state money or federal money going through the state down to its lower levels of government where it's actually spent. So my position is, if this is an authority that you want to give the audit division, that would be fine. But I would add that you may want to consider whether you want us to have access to confidential information at that local level, if it's generated through the use of state funds. That would be an effectiveness issue for the audit division, and then require the cooperation of not only state agencies but any local agencies. That would be an efficiency issue as well.
So I would ask you, are you in support of this bill as written?
Madam Chairman, if the legislature wants the audit division to be able to follow all state money into local governments and nonprofits, then I believe that Section 11 will do that for us. However, the two other issues that I would have is, and again, I think they're both public policy concerns, do you want us to be able to look at confidential information if generated and require the assistance of state and local officials? I think those are, as I said, those are efficiency and effectiveness issues for the audit division.
Okay, and then just a follow-up, I would say to you, of course, by doing additional duties and following state money or federal money or whatever, you're going to have an increase in staff because to handle additional work. So what do you envision that?
Madam Chairman, actually, we gave this bill a zero fiscal note.
I saw that.
The reason being is it doesn't mandate any new audits for us. What it does is it allows the Budget and Audit Committee to approve additional audits. The way that we sort of currently operate with our budget is about 70% of our workload is mandated by statute. The other 30% of our workload are legislative requests that's approved by the committee, and they come on a first-come, first-served basis. Mm-hmm. If we are not producing those audit reports in a timely manner, I'm going to hear about it, and we're going to have a discussion about staffing and whether we're meeting the legislative needs or not. And so, again, this may increase it, in which case I'll be having a discussion with the chairman of the Budget and Audit Committee in terms of whether he wants to see the audit division increase in staff or not, but it doesn't right now mandate any new audits for us.
Okay, and then Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Pat, what's your backlog now? Is it about a year? If somebody was to request an audit and it got approved, it would be about a year before it would get completed?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, probably somewhere between 6 to 9 months.
Okay.
The one thing is, as you're all grappling with the stimulus money, the federal auditors are already talking in our ears about the additional audit requirements that come along with that money. And so while normally that statewide single audit that covers all the federal requirements eats up about 60% of our budget, it's going to be going up. And that workload is probably going to be there for the next 4 to 5 years as well.
So, Madam Chair, as Ms. Davison explained, she doesn't need any additional staff to do what's being asked here in the bill. It's just that if we want it done faster than the 6 to 9 months or year, whatever the case may be, then yeah, we'd have to add staff, and of course that would affect that would change the fiscal note. But I do have some concern with the federal money, in the sense that, you know, we are responsible for state money, and I accept that and agree with that 100%. But the federal money, even if you do an audit and you see that, say, a school district, the federal money came to the state and then we passed it on to the school district, what do we do with those results of your audit? I mean, do you give it back to some federal agency and hope that they take action, or?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, actually, I would say that the federal government is, I don't know if the better is the word I'm looking for or not, they are more consistent about putting audit requirements associated with their federal money than the state is with the money it passes out. So any federal money that gets passed from the state level to a federal level, the federal government is looking to the state agency to be accountable for how that money is spent. The system of audits that are set up right now is the single audit approach. And so whether federal money comes to, let's say, a school district, either directly to that school district from the state, when the auditors are in there, they will be doing federal compliance work to make sure that that money is spent in accordance with the federal requirements. Then state agencies are responsible for taking any findings from those audits and act on those. Mm-hmm. And so right now, the layer for federal money is pretty well complete. But with all single audits, there's thresholds for what you have to audit and what you don't have to audit and how much you have to audit, depending upon the value of the or the amount of money that you're getting. So the federal dollars passing through right now are pretty consistently have audit requirements associated with them.
Okay, thank you. One more follow-up. Pat, that includes, I think you said it does, the economic stimulus money that we're now starting to get also has audit requirements assigned to it.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I know that the U.S. Office of Management and Budget, the General Accounting Office, and the Inspector Generals in each department right now are scrambling to come up with what they call the compliance supplements, which are the regulations that the auditors will have to follow when auditing that money. And my understanding is they're cranking those things up for us to look at more rather than less when it comes to the economic stimulus money.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. Pat, how are you?
Morning.
My question is the same question I asked Senator Dyson regarding the scope of these audits should we adopt a bill like this, and whether the receipt of a fairly small amount of state money would enable the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to order an audit of the entire organization. And the way I currently read what's on page 2, lines 24 and 25, suggests to me that the receipt of just a little bit of state money would allow you to perform an audit of an organization that receives money from or through the state. And it seems to me that we're now allowing a thorough sort of top-to-bottom review of any organization that got any amount of money from the state, and that concerns me just from a efficiency perspective. You know, if someone wanted you to look at the Boy Scouts of Alaska's, you know, organization from stem to stern because they got $5,000 for a ball field somewhere, that strikes me as being not a wise use of state resources. But do you sort of see how that language could be a little broader than perhaps what we need?
Through the chair, Senator French, as I read the section the first time, And I guess in my background and in running into that exact situation is we would follow the state money. What can happen is that there would be some overlap. For example, if $5,000 of state money was commingled with $10,000 of
Rasmussen money or private money.
Exactly. And we were asked to audit, we would limit ourselves as much as possible to the $5,000. However, when you get into an organization that small, you're not going to find a sophisticated accounting system where they are setting up controls and everything else for different pots of money. And as a result, and what I've seen in our experience before is our valuation would be of the system overall. However, we would be focusing in any detail work on just the $5,000 that that came from the state. And again, that would be something as the request goes through the Budget and Audit Committee, I would expect those are the type of questions I would be getting.
Thank you. And just more as a comment, Madam Chair, Ms. Davidson has a sterling reputation, and she knows her stuff from stem to stern. But I guess just for my own purposes, for the, looking down the road to posterity, should we adopt this, I would be interested in having it be a little more tightly written with respect to what the powers of the both Legislative Budget Audit and the Auditing Board would be. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, I'm sorry, Senator Cass.
I guess to in part address Senator French's question, if the audit is approved in the approving language, could those restrictions be put in at that time? In other words, as I read that last qualifier, when the performance of the audit is approved, that you would approve the audit, and then if there were restrictions, they could be inserted at the time of the approval. Would that be, how do you envision the process working?
Through the chair, Senator Pascvan, the audits that are approved by the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee are generated from individual legislators. They write to the committee chairman requesting an audit. And in that audit request, they have to identify what the objective of the audit is. Oftentimes, and they have to submit it 5 days in advance of a meeting, which gives both the committee and myself an opportunity to review that to make sure that we understand what the requester wants. Mm-hmm. I think that with Senator French's concern about auditing outside state money, this would give us, certainly the legislature has authority over state funds, but I'm not sure that even the legislature can order an audit of raffle receipts of an organization. Right. And so there's an inherent limitation on what we're going to be able to audit because the authority is being generated from the legislature. And that's why, what we have done in the past before is, we look at what we're allowed to look at. Whether what this does is it allows us to move from state agencies down to nonprofits and local governments. I didn't read it to expand it beyond state funds or federal funds flowing from the state.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. If there's no one else to testify, I'm going to close. Oh, did you want to come forward?
Okay. Pat, stay close here. You raised some excellent questions, and as I remember our previous conversations, when I've said to Pat, could you, if you needed to, hire some contract help? Hire some auditors to supplement. And I believe the answer was yes. And Pat has. So if indeed we in our wisdom working through LBNA decide that something is of a priority, both time-wise and expertise-wise and so on, that Pat's staff, Ms. Davidson's staff need to be supplemented. The tools are in place.
Okay, good.
It was a good catch on Ms. Davidson's part here about whether or not we need to make it clear here in the fifth and sixth ones that if they're auditing an organization that's not a state organization, what access do they have? And I don't want to presuppose what action you will take, but I'm going to go off and work on fixing that piece and very quickly, like today, and so on. So, and if we don't fix that and one in line one today, do it. But I also want to reiterate my appeal to you to make this a committee bill, if you should so choose. I think it's excellent public policy. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I think then we will close public testimony if there's no one else to speak on this. Do any members, and we'll open it up for discussion amongst the members. We'll move on now to discussion. Okay, Senator Myers, because we could add an amendment here on the may and the keeping it to shall.
Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd like to move amendment number one.
Okay.
I guess it doesn't have a number on it, but I think it's the only amendment we have. And it does exactly what was mentioned by Ms. Davidson. Changes, inserts the word duties. And on page one, line 4 and 5, deletes may and inserts shall.
Okay, is there any discussion on that or any objection? Okay, seeing none, we can move that amendment. And then what is the will of the committee?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator French.
I guess I'll do a conceptual amendment. It looks like this bill may be getting ready to leave committee and go up to finance, but before it goes there, I guess I'd like to say that on page two, line 24, I would propose an amendment, and it could be a conceptual amendment, that essentially says that the audit, in conformity with the testimony we heard from Ms. Davidson, that the audit function be restricted to the state dollars that an organization receives, and not an umbrella audit. I, as I said before, thoroughly trust her representation that that's what would happen, but reading the language here, that's not what the language says. The language says perform an audit of an organization that receives money from or through the state. That is a sweeping statement, and I think it's too broad.
Okay, is there any other discussion? Okay, I will allow you to.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, and a good catch on the part of Senator French. I would encourage you to consider whether or not that it includes state or federal funds that flow through the state in what we could do. I think the way you said it was only follow state funds. So I'd encourage you to consider a phrase state funds or public funds flowing through the state, where I think we still have a stewardship responsibility. Respectfully.
Okay. Is Senator French?
Just a comment. I mean, no one wants to see fraud, waste, and abuse, right? Nobody does. On the other hand, you know, the powers of the federal government to watch their own money versus our ability to watch their money, I think, are out of whack. And, you know, I just soon spend state money to watch state dollars. So, in my view, the right thing to do is to take a day and draft something that tightens this and then pass it out at the next hearing. But if the will of the committee is to push it up to finance, we can do the best we can on the fly and then see what they do with it.
Okay, thank you. What is the will of the committee? Do you want to pass it out? I'm amiable either way. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I think the sponsor of the bill had requested a day or two to rework it. So
we can take it up on Thursday again with that.
I'll draft something and circulate it to the sponsor and see if we can come to terms before we get to the hearing.
Okay, I appreciate that. Okay.
Good,
good solution to a little problem. Thank you. Okay, with that, we'll take just a short at ease. We'll come back into our state affairs meeting. Let's move on now to Senate Bill 23, Repeal Divine Contribution Retirement Plan. Let's see, Jesse, are you want to come forward as our staff member and state your name and affiliation and give some testimony and present the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. Just as a method of introduction, this bill was originally drafted by former Senator Kim Elton and his staff, and in particular Jesse Keel, and they have invested a tremendous amount of time and energy into Senate Bill 23, and I am honored to carry this legislation forward on behalf of former Senator Elton and the bill's 8 remaining co-sponsors, and we'll soon turn the spotlight on Jesse, but in the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, I think that we took a very good bill and made it a little bit better, and we did that based upon the recommendations of the Chief Financial Officer of the Fairbanks North Star Borough, who was presenting testimony on his own behalf, not as the official representative of that organization, but as a Chief Financial Officer. And I think it's important to let it be known that I do support Senate Bill 23. I think it's sound social policy. The teachers, police, firefighters, and other public employees, I think, earn the right to dignified retirement. I think it will help in recruiting. I think it will help in retention. I think it's sound fiscal policy. We know that between the DB and the DC, it's nearly a wash. There's studies, a better bang for the buck out of the executive director of the National Institute of Retirement Security, the studies that they've done. I hope that we can have Beth Almeida from that organization back to this committee as well. I think that the defined benefit does add a stabilizing influence as presented at the Labor and Commerce Committee. The expenditures and retirement benefits in the state of Alaska in the year 2006 accounted for 6,270 jobs and paid $385 million in income within the state of Alaska. It was $1 billion in total economic output, and it accounted for $155 million in federal, state, and local tax revenue. So I do support Senate Bill 23 and thank this committee for hearing Senate Bill 23 and introduce Jesse Keel, who is from Senator Elton's office, and he's the one that the spotlight should be on for the details.
Okay, thank you, Senator Passman. Okay, Jesse.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jesse Keel. I'm staff to Senate District B. And my thanks this morning to you and the committee for hearing the bill and to Senator Passman for his support and help in carrying the bill. A brief description, Madam Chair, of Senate Bill 23 as it comes to you from the Labor and Commerce Committee. The bill probably needs a new short title. It no longer repeals the defined contribution plan. Those statutes remain on the books. However, it places virtually all new hires to the state of Alaska and its political subdivisions like municipalities, as well as Alaska school districts, into the defined benefit pension system. It provides, as Senator Passman alluded to, a very limited group of professionals, experienced professionals, with a choice, the opportunity to choose the defined contribution plan. Specifically, those folks who come into state or school district employment with a defined benefit pension already, somebody who's fully vested in something other than PERS and TERS. Those folks already have retirement security. Often they would be, for instance, a retired career military person, and are a great catch for a state employer or a municipality, and so they would have the opportunity to elect the DC plan. All other new hires would go into the defined benefit program. Specifically, Madam Chair, they would be hired into the least expensive tiers of the defined benefit pension systems. So for the public employees retirement system, that would be Tier 3. For teachers, that would be Tier 2. Those are the most restrictive of the defined benefit, the pension systems, the most difficult to vest in a pension, most difficult to vest, rather, and most importantly, in the health care benefit. However, they still provide a very good and adequate and secure retirement for their beneficiaries who remain in public employment long enough to vest in the benefits. I won't repeat what Senator Pascavan told you about getting a better bang for the buck. There's a fair amount of information in the committee's packet, certainly a fair amount of information on the public record. There's one wonderful chart in the committee's packet showing just an illustrative case, a couple of examples, the difference between two employees who start at the same age and time, and the more valuable benefit both that public employee and that teacher would get from the defined benefit system. The greatest benefits to the state and to the school district, to public employers, Madam Chair, are really the great incentive for employees to stay on, and the fact that a better benefit helps recruit, especially over the long term, recruit better employees. With the defined contribution program, you can take not only the money that came out of your paycheck into your individual account with you when you leave, but you can take the boss's money. The defined benefit system doesn't take your money away if you leave. You could potentially cash out, and many people do each year, but your employer's money, the money that the state or the municipality put into the pension system, that stays. It earns interest and dividends and helps fund the benefits for other folks. It is a strong incentive for employees to stay on, and that's important, Madam Chair, because states, municipalities, school districts spend a lot of money training employees. In past years, and I don't have an updated number, I apologize, we've heard from the Department of Administration that the state of Alaska, it's not at all uncommon to spend $15,000 training a new employee. Public safety employers, especially municipal police departments, have testified to numbers more on the order of $150,000 to train a new employee. Turning them over in a hurry is not good management. Defined benefit systems help keep good employees, Madam Chair. Rather than go on at great length about the benefits, I think I will make myself available for any questions of the committee.
Okay. Any committee members have any questions? Okay. Senator Meyer?
Just one, Madam Chair. I do appreciate, in fact, I was on Labor and Commerce where we made the change to make this optional to those who already have a retirement with government. What about the employee, though, who really has no intention of staying more than 5, 6, 7 years, like perhaps a college professor, you know, where they like to go from college to college to advance their career? They would not have the option of a DB or a DC plan. Is that correct? The only time you have an option is if you're already fully vested in a DB plan.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, that's correct. That's the way the bill is written today.
I don't know. Would the sponsor, I guess he doesn't care anymore. is that something that you think the committee or the sponsor would entertain, is to make this optional to any new employee to either go to the DB or DC plan? Or is that opening up too much, in your opinion?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, there are a number of questions that arise with a program like that. I should point out that the University of Alaska has what they call the Optional Retirement Program, or they refer to it as ORP. We love our initials and our acronyms. But one of the things that we've talked at some length with the Department of Administration about is the fact that a system like that actually increases costs. And not to get too deeply into the details, it is what the actuaries refer to as adverse selection. The folks who are, on the whole, most expensive to provide a secure pension to, folks who, for instance, are 10 years from retirement, are just about guaranteed not to choose defined contribution. They're going to choose that defined benefit pension that gives you a full health benefit at 10 years of service. Whereas folks who cost the least, folks who might be entering state service at age 22 or 23 or out of college, for instance, are more likely to choose that defined contribution. And so it changes the demographics of the pool. And when you blend them together, they end up costing more. That's one of the great concerns that I think Senator Elton had with the notion of going to a full choice program for all new employees. The other, of course, is the question of retirement security, and the recent performance in the markets have shown us that we're doing a lot better with professional investment managers, Madam Chair. The numbers as of the end of the calendar year showed that the professional investment managers at Department of Revenue, who manage the pension trust funds, at the end of calendar year 2008, they were down about 22% for the year. Record losses in the market hit everybody. The defined contribution accounts, the individual accounts, Madam Chair, were down on average about 35%, a staggering difference in the amount of wealth that's available. The other thing that is relevant here to Senator Meyer's question is that the Department of Administration has issued guidance to state departments that when a state employee goes to an investing seminar that we put on, especially and primarily for the folks in the DC plan, that's work time. You're on the clock. You don't have to use your leave. In essence, paying state troopers, fish biologists, file clerks, to learn about investing instead of catching bad guys, filing documents, counting fish. At the same time, we're paying professional investment managers in the Department of Revenue to invest. It may not be the most efficient use of state resources.
Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. And perhaps this question is better for someone in the administration. But it just seems to me, anymore, unfortunately, we are having to go outside to recruit for certain positions, whether it be police officers or state patrol or teachers or et cetera, that if you as the recruiter, if you can offer this young person either plan, because bottom line, some of these younger kids, they may think, hey, I'd love to come to Alaska for 5 or 6 years, but I don't want to live there all my life. So I'm attracted to the fact that I can get a DC plan. It just seems that from a recruiting standpoint, to offer both gives you that much more tools in your tool bags, so to speak, to try to attract and hire these the younger people. But it's not that big an issue to me. It's just something that I'm thinking might be helpful to whoever's doing the recruiting for the state and for the local municipalities and school districts.
Okay, thank you. Is there any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Jesse, okay, Senator French.
Just briefly, and you'll have to excuse me, I've got a budget closeout that suddenly grabbing my attention. I'll have to leave in a minute, but I just wanted to get on the record a letter that, and maybe it's better through Mr. Shire, who I see in the audience, but I see a letter February 12, 2009 from Buck Consultants to Mr. Shire about the relative costs of the two plans. I don't know if that's been put on the record, but it's an illuminating letter, at least to me, and I wanted to have either Mr. Keel or Mr. Shire describe the give a synopsis of the letter.
Okay, and I can allow Mr. Shire to come up now. Does anybody have any other questions of Jesse? Okay, thank you. Pat Shire, you're from Division of Retirement and Benefits. Would you
Madam
state
Chair.
Your name and please and affiliation and give some testimony for us?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Shire. I currently serve as Division Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits in the Department of Administration. And I, through the chair, Senator French, you asked about the Buck letter, February 12, 2009. Specifically, your question, if you had stated.
The relative costs of each plan. I mean, that looks like what sort of the bottom line of the letter is. And so I just, you may understand some of the variables better than I do. And so I want to get your, get the numbers on the record and then get your sort of gloss on them.
Very well. If we look at page one, we see a comparison for the public employees retirement system PERS between the DB plan tier 3 and the DCR plan tier 4. And this is normal cost only. It includes components for both pension. You see the 2.97% at the top of that column. That's the average normal cost rate for a DB employee, 7.98% for medical cost normal, and the total 10.95, compared to the DCR rate of 5% for pension, 0.38 for occupational death and disability, 0.85% for health, 3% for the health reimbursement arrangement, for a total of 9.23.
Can I just stop right there? Can you maybe just explain how those medical costs can be so wildly different? I mean, well, one is 7.98 for medical normal cost rate for DB Tier 3, and then DCR looks like 0.85, and then plus 3%, which is literally half of what we're paying for the Tier 3 employees. Why is that?
Through Chairman, Senator French. It is plan design. Most of that is plan design. There is also a significant feature separating the defined benefit plan from defined contribution for health in that you must retire out of the system in the DCR plan in order to have access to the health plan, to the employer-paid health plan. It's been unclear to many that we've spoken to that the defined contribution retirement plan is actually hybrid. The health plan in that system is paid for entirely by employer contributions. That's the 0.85%. That describes the cost of putting money away now to pay health claims under that plan for those that gain access by retiring out of the system and staying long enough. There's cost sensitivity in the new plan because even retirees will have to pay some portion of the premium that's the going rate at the time for that health plan. We are designing into that some health improvement features and other sensitivities to cost in and out of network mixes. Those are not in the current health plan right now.
Okay, is there any other questions? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just follow up on my previous question. That is, if the administration would be open to having a complete option to new employees, the DB or defined contribution, either one, I guess it'd be Tier 3 or Tier 4. And then what are the costs associated with that? Because I would think that, at least based on the numbers you have here, the defined benefit is more expensive to the state. So if you could get some of the new employees to take the defined contribution for whatever reason, because, you know, let's say they don't plan on staying in Alaska for more than 5 or 6 years, that would be beneficial. However, I'm not sure the administration even supports going back to a defined benefit. I think last time we talked that you were neutral on that.
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, the administration remains concerned about any move in the retirement systems that would add to future costs going forward and or to the unfunded liability. We have re-examined the fiscal note based on input from the plan sponsor, and it still shows in 2011 and on a significant increase in costs, even under the limited choice provision in the current version of the CS. And so we remain very cautious about taking a positive position, certainly on a bill that would add that kind of cost. In terms of what this may or may not do for recruitment, again, we really don't know how positive that effect may be or how significant it may be. It's been said on the record in a prior committee hearing that about 20% of the PERS workforce is now defined contribution retirement. Thousands of people literally have been hired under the new tier for both PERS and TERS. We mentioned retention, that individuals may be incented to stay longer. However, we must remember that in the defined benefit plan, after 10 years, an individual can leave the state of Alaska, employment with the state of Alaska or a political subdivision or a school district. It's actually a little shorter than that. And they take with them that guarantee to pay a pension and health care for the rest of their life after they retire. Age 60 would be the normal retirement age. Under the current defined contribution retirement plan, if a worker wants access to that health care, they must stay, work in the system a sufficient number of years, and then retire directly out of the system in order to have access. So we would be consistent with our prior testimony in saying we really don't have the data to show definitively that recruitment and retention are materially affected by the current DCR plan.
Just one more follow-up.
Okay, follow-up, Mr. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then can you help me as far as the administrative costs? Would it be significantly more for you to have both plans, a DB and a DC? So in other words, if we were to change this bill to make it completely optional to the new employee to go either way, does that create more expense for you to try to manage two plans, or would you rather see one or the other?
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, complexity adds cost in administration. And we would certainly work to minimize any costs of administration. But certainly when there's a choice, and there are some features in the bill we've had discussions with the bill sponsor about the number of days required to get notice to new employees, and we've heard some flexibility in that. In any case, a choice would create some additional complexity and some additional cost. We have another fiscal note regarding the operations costs that are not insignificant in calculating what the amount of defined contribution balance an individual may have if they choose to go to the defined benefit, what it would take in order to calculate the actuarially equivalent period of service time. And that represents some transition costs, certainly. But on an ongoing basis, every time we make a change to the system, we do introduce some complexity and we have some costs.
Thank you.
Okay.
Just
Senator Passman.
Yes. You know, the fiscal note, for example, 2012, it indicates the cost at approximately $16 million, and that's, I believe, based on an assumption that all people would return to the defined benefit. Is that an accurate reflection of that number?
Madam Chairman, mm-hmm. Senator Passman, yes, and the fiscal note that you're referring to, the identifier SBO 23 DOA DRB 022409 reflects that number. In conversations with the staff of the sponsor, we retooled that with our better understanding and produced a fiscal note for CSSB 023 dated 31609, and it shows a slightly lower number, $15 million. That reflects the idea that there will be choice. We have reduced the number in that year to reflect the idea that there's choice, so it's a reduction of just a little over $1 million.
And so that the public policy issue is framed a little more closely, that $15 million is the cost in reference to approximately a $3 billion payroll, so that $15 million is maybe 0.5% of a payroll cost.
Madam Chairman, mm-hmm. Senator Passman, it reflects the change in the normal cost rate. And that increase for both PERS and TERS, when you include the health portion, actually goes over 1%. And it's fractional when we're talking pension, but when we add in the health care, it actually goes over 1%. So it's more than 1%.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. As I mentioned, we're going to go ahead and hold this for now and maybe reschedule it for Thursday if there's no objection. Okay.
Madam Chair, you're going to leave public testimony open then so people can testify on Thursday?
On Thursday, there's no public testimony today.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, let's short at ease. Take. Now we'll have House CSHB 63, Council on Domestic Violence member staff. Representative Faircloth, would you please come forward with for your bill, state your name and affiliation, and give us some testimony?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing House Bill 63. My name is Representative Anna Faircloth out of District 17, Eagle River, Alaska. First, happy St. Patty's Day to all of you. I see you're all festive in green, so for those at home and here in the audience, it's a nice sunny day in Juneau. It's a nice to celebrate a bit of the Irish.
And what a ring.
I was at Fred Meyer's last night in an attempt not to be without green today, and yes, bought an emerald that only costume jewelry could afford me.
You don't have matching earrings, though, do you?
I don't. They didn't have them for sale for $3.99. Members of the committee, Madam Chair, 28 out of the last 30 years, Alaska has ranked number one in our nation for sexual assault. Mm-hmm. We have some horrific numbers in this state, many numbers that we should be proud of, but not when it comes to violence in our state. To that end, in the 25th legislature, both bodies of our government, as well as the governor, signed into law a task force for us to relook at how we delivered services to people who are afflicted, who experience domestic violence and sexual assault, and that state agency, and how they were fulfilling their role and their obligation to the state of Alaska and its residents. And through that, the task force put together a report, and that's been available. I'm sorry, I've got it clipped in here. And it was distributed to the 25th legislature. I was chair of that task force, a sponsor of that legislation, and it had a bicameral, bipartisan committee that put together, and this legislation is bicameral and bipartisan in its support. And as you said, Senator Elton has moved on to other things, but he was part of the bill that's before you today and endorses what we have before you. So if I could briefly walk through what the bill does so that you we have the changes for the record, and I'll highlight the large changes. What it does is it changes the number of the members of the council from 7 to 9, and it adds one new public member, and it adds one new member from the Department of Corrections. Previously, Health and Human Services used to have correction as a component of it, and so it gives us the opportunity to start talking about prevention as well as accountability and go through the full spectrum of what happens to both the victim and a perpetrator of a crime, and better respond to those issues as they relate to victims and as they relate to justice for our system. It also requires one of the public members to be from a rural community, and the CS defines that rural community as 7,500 and under. And there's some more fine-tuning about being on and off the road system. It changes the term of office for those who serve on the council from 2 to 3 years. What we experienced in our review as a task force was that people who were sitting on the council didn't have the opportunity to receive adequate training and only sometimes saw a budget before them once during their whole entire time before in their service on the council. And so this expands that ability to have some historical perspective on there for just a bit longer. There was great controversy in previous years when we talked about funding the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault and the people who were appointed to the council. And there was concern that the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault is currently written in statute that the governor shall talk to the network and shall review nominations from the council. We talked about this, and we have consensus overall, bipartisan, bicameral, non-profits and profits alike. No one is standing on that mountain anymore. May is fine. We certainly encourage. I tried to use that word inside of legislation, but Alleged Legal corrected me that we don't encourage people in statutes. We allow it being permissive, or we don't allow it, or we force it to happen in the word shall. And so I certainly would encourage the governor to utilize the resource of the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, which is a membership program of 19 programs throughout the state of Alaska that address these issues. This bill also clarifies that a public member is not supposed to be a member or an employee of the state of Alaska. I'm not sure if all of you know, but I'm the previous executive director of Standing Together Against Rape, so I was a member in standing of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault and had testified before the council, and so have some firsthand experience with that. And on one occasion when I was an executive director standing before the council, it looked like a scenery of all state employees, and I am certain they were all doing the very best job, and I certainly wouldn't want to cast any kind of shadow on the decisions they were making, but it didn't feel like there was a true public member there listening to what I was saying. And so this ensures that public members can't have a dual role inside of state government and then be that public member on the council.
And Representative, as you're walking us through, would you say which number you're on, because it is a larger bill, if you have that.
The sectional analysis, I can follow up by that. I was trying to give highlights. Section 1 is where it amends the council from 3 to 4 public members, and it adds the language that the public member should be from a rural community. Right. It also adds, where I said before, the Department of Correction and onto the council. Mm-hmm. Section 1 also changes the public member from 2 to 3 years, and it changes the language from shall to may for the consultation with the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence. Section 1 also adds a language that deals with the members appointed to the council that they can't be a state employee. So pretty much everything that I've covered to date is reflected in Section 1. Section 2 defines the term of a rural area. Mm-hmm. Section 3 changes the quorum requirements. Section 4 changes the council from a non-exempt staff positions other than the executive director and adds the Department of Corrections in regard to coordination of services. Section 5 modifies the appropriate language and statutes that deal with exempt employees, making them non-exempt. And Section 6 adds a new subsection dealing with the appointment of a new member on the council and its effective date. And it extends the term from 2 to 3 years.
Okay, thank you. Your highlights.
Thank you. Madam Chair, it was brought to my attention late yesterday afternoon that upon looking at the exempt and non-exempt status, and I spoke with you earlier today about that and asked for the committee's help in trying to deal with this issue. It was brought to my attention that there is now a question of whether the current staff would have to take a pay decrease to be able to move from an exempt position into a non-exempt position. It was also stated to me that it is unknown at this time whether they would have to have a waiting period for their health insurance if they transferred from the exempt plan to a non-exempt plan, and whether a pre-existing conditions under the exempt plan would be allowed under the new non-exempt plan. In addition, there was grave concern, I said, about a pay decrease, and the relationship between the step and the exempt classification as it crossed over. And so, Chairman Ard, what I asked you to do was either I have an amendment that's conceptual that would strip that particular component out of the bill so that I could go to Ledge Legal and to Personnel Division and see if there was a different way to write it, or hold the bill, or ask for questions of if committee members have any experience that I don't have. I haven't dealt with this particular issue in moving forward, so I don't know if there are other options on the table for us. But the whole reason why the task force supported it was we were told that turnover was an issue inside of the department and that staff members at the council should not be at the same exposure rate as the administration's change, as a new governor comes in and she's certainly, or he's certainly, entitled to place key people in positions to carry out their will, that the underlying staff is of great value there in administrations of grants and continuity for programs and the people that they administer. So that's why we recommended it. It's been 2.5 years where everyone was going forward, but when the rubber hit the road as far as implementation, new issues were raised, and I certainly don't want to advocate for people to lose money or lose benefits or be somehow put off for this. We were trying to secure their positions currently as they exist today and let them have that non-exempt position, which would require a different kind of probation
And that's why it was not my intent to move the bill today, but to allow you to have more time, and maybe we could even schedule it for Thursday if you can get with legal services and see what and have those questions answered.
Madam Chair, that would be wonderful. I just was throwing out, I know that all of you have had different experiences, and if you could point me in a direction, that would be helpful too. One, I just want to true up that all of what has been given to me is accurate, and to see if we do in fact have to strip it out, or is there a way, Madam Chair, committee members, that we can say that as of July 1st, 2009, any future employees will be hired in a non-exempt status under that, so that the current employees can sort of retain that status. I'm not sure if that creates inequity. That's what I need to talk to legal.
Senator French.
I appreciate the sponsor's sensitivity to this point. I guess I just ask sort of who the expert is on that particular topic, because I don't know myself. I haven't worked through it. And so I appreciate your willingness to sort of look for a creative solution. But as we explore it over the next couple of days, my question will continue to be, sort of who is the guru of state employment classification and continuity of benefits and so forth in the move from one form of employment to another.
Do you have that information, or you want to research?
Madam Chair, that's what I need to research. I was hoping that someone
I asked it back. Yeah.
I was hoping, Madam Chair, that someone on the committee could pull the rabbit out of that hat for me, or the Irish. You give me a bit of Irish today.
Right.
We need to look.
Okay, is there any other questions?
I just had
Senator Passmann.
One question. What prompted the change on rural definition, increasing it from 55 to 75 and then from 1,500 to 3,500? What prompted that?
Okay. Through the chair, Senator. Pascavan, is that correct?
Pascavan.
Pascavan, thank you, sir. Madam Chair, there was conversation in the other body that there was a concern in limiting Bethel. The bottom line is Bethel wouldn't have been included as a rural community. They would have had to compete for a regular position. And Representative Heron brought the concern to me. We looked through statute. Ledge Legal specifically had given me the different definition because they thought it was used more consistently through Alaska state statute. But after Representative Heron brought the issue to me, then our staff did a global search and come to find out there were five different definitions of rural that were available to be used in state statute. And so we expanded that, which does help the administration also in the fact that when we limited it under 5,000, there were fewer people that could actually apply or might be interested in the issue. So the expansion to 75 included Bethel to be included as a rural community should they so choose. Bethel could go either direction for a public member or not, or their outlying communities, and it allowed the administration a little bit more flexibility in trying to fill the rural position on the council.
Okay. Did you have a follow-up?
No, that's satisfactory.
Thank you, Representative. Anybody else? Okay, thank you very much. So, with that, and there's no testimony up there, we won't go ahead and move the bill, and I don't see anything else on our agenda, so our state affairs meeting is over.
All right.